Welcome to another edition of Lying on the Beach. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman.
And you know, they say that you can't judge a book by its cover. Well, that couldn't be more true when you meet Tricia Posner. She is a much respected British nonfiction writer who lives in Miami Beach along with her very successful author husband, Gerald Posner. And when you meet them, they look like movie stars or Broadway stars. They obviously work out, they're very fashionable, and they devote themselves to all kinds of worthy causes. It's difficult to believe that the two of them spend so much time, their waking hours, just researching and writing because they look so great. In recent years, Tricia dominated the headlines worldwide for a book she wrote, The Pharmacist of Auschwitz, The Untold Story. It's one of the most important books to be published in recent times because it really wakes everyone up to how a peaceful world can become a catastrophe in such a short period of time. Tricia is also the author of This Is Not Your Mother's Menopause, One Woman's Natural Journey Through Change, and No Hormones, No Fear. So first off, welcome, Tricia. Thank you very much for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Hi, thank you very much for having me, Steve and Lois.
And I'm going to jump right into the number one question I have in my mind. Anti-Semitism is on the rise in the United States and around the world. There are more than 1,800 incidents in the U.S. last year, one of the record setters. It's always been active in certain pockets of the globe. But why do you think right now we're seeing such a why it's going into high gear right now? What do you suppose that is?
Well, I think, you know, if we really look back in history, it's like a cycle. It's been around for 2,000 years. And after the Holocaust, it seemed to die down somewhat. It went underground. And I think part of that was because the Holocaust and what the Nazis did was so horrific that people felt almost embarrassed to show what they really felt. So they, as I said, they went underground. But I think it's been bubbling on the surface now for a number of reasons. Anti-Semitism, you know, people can't separate, for whatever reason, is the anti-Israel thing. So Israel is a Jewish state, but we as Jews around the world are not from Israel. So they can't separate it. I mean, so many times it will happen to me that people don't understand that being Jewish and being from Israel is two different things. I've never been to Israel, by the way. So people are always amazed by that. And the other reason, I don't know if you read the UN report recently, the mass immigration of Muslims to Western Europe have brought in their background with the schools have taught them hatred of Israel and Jews for so long. And of course, we have leaders like my country, England, my old home, I should say, Jeremy Corbyn, who's a vehement anti-Semite. And of course you have Trump, who's, I hate to say this, insensitive and not proactive when it comes to the situation. And social media has given it such a platform. People can so come out and say what they want and be bullies. And, you know, I remember being bullied at school. So this is a different type of bullying. They can make their little platforms, deny the Holocaust, and the lack of interest in mainstream media is extraordinary to me. I mean, look what's going on in New York. I don't know if you've been following it, or the Hasidim with the attacks. And no, you don't see it. When I do my searches every day, it never comes up in mainstream media. It comes up nowhere. Or the problems that we had, I don't know if you saw, there was a British piece by Panorama that was about Jeremy Corbyn and the anti-Semitism within the party, not just him. Nothing was covered here, not a thing, nothing at all. So I think it's, you know, when you've lived like I have, in a bullied world of anti-Semitism, it's very frightening, actually.
And you know, I can remember just recently, the last election, there was a political ad that ran in Rockland County that was really filled with anti-Semitism against Orthodox Jews because they were afraid that Orthodox Jews were going to be taking over Rockland County or some such nonsense. But the ad was so blatantly anti-Semitic, you know, they, I it's just amazing. Our tolerance seems to keep going higher and higher. What we allow to exist.
If you look at the Orthodox community, what's happening in Brooklyn, and I think one was whipped with a belt, one had a stone in his head, one had to stuff a young man, and his son had something thrown. But it's not, I mean, no one seems to know about it. No one's acknowledging what's going on.
Well, you certainly are, Tricia, on Facebook. You're really doing your part. What do you think Jews could do today, like someone like Steve and myself, to counteract the hatred?
Well, be aware of it. Speak out. Not be afraid to speak out. I mean, I can remember when I was growing up, not my parents and not my family, but a lot of people around us was the old kind of Jewish way, oh, leave it alone, you know, go away, don't let's talk about it, don't make a fuss. I don't think we can be quiet anymore because it's not going to go away. I think it's going to get worse.
Definitely will get worse.
And I know from my own childhood.
And I think your book, it really kind of also shows how hatred is, first of all, it's everywhere. It's kind of in everyone's heart a little bit. And then given the right set of variables, it can turn into something catastrophic very easily.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of shocking because most people think, oh, Nazis, well, that's not us. We're, you know, those are a different breed of people. But they were just like, you know, the pharmacists and butchers and candlestick makers and everything else that we are. And they can turn into these monsters.
They were just ordinary men, as was the man in my book, Victor Capizzi. It was just an ordinary, rep for Bayer aspirin and pharmaceuticals. And it's amazing how when a person is put in a situation, what he or she would do, you know, and Auschwitz was certainly one of the worst places to be. And to think that not only did he make the selections, that he administrated the Cyclone B, and the stealing, you know, the stealing of when the goods would be dropped off off the trains and he would ramage through them and steal the gold and eventually take that gold and open up a pharmacy. I mean, it's mind-boggling, really, when you think of it. I can't imagine what any of us would do in a situation like that. I don't know. It's just horrible. It's to think that people could just stand back and watch this happen.
You know, there was most of my life until the Trump era, I thought it could never happen again. It was just like I would have taken $1 million and bet, you know, it just can't happen. Those were the days. Everybody's more enlightened now. Jews are protected. There's so many famous Jews. Nobody would like let anything happen to Barbara Streisand, David Geffen, blah, blah, blah. But I see what's going on now, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is happening right before our eyes, and we're not doing anything about it. It's just amazing.
But when I got here, let me say something to you. When I got here in 1978, this was a haven for me. I arrived in New York, a little younger, let's say, and there was something about being in New York that gave me a sense of security and well-being because I felt for the first time being Jewish, they were like Jewish shops, you showed the, I remember seeing on television, it was extraordinary to me, you showed Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. I wasn't brought up that way. So I felt very secure living in America and being Jewish. And I never thought in a million years would I start seeing this. Never. So I couldn't agree with you more. And the scary part is it's all over, I mean, it's all over Europe. I mean, Germany, Australia, New Zealand. I mean, you could keep going on.
Yes,
and
you read
on
about
and
it.
On
yes,
and on. It's everywhere. But it's unless you really research it and look for it, you don't see it. It hasn't just happened. Believe me, it's
right.
Been creeping up over the years and over the years and over the years. It's been creeping up. For whatever reason, we're always what the expression is: the whipping boy. There's always the Jews that's blamed for everything.
But Tricia, you really hit upon it. Most Jews don't want to talk about it because if you talk about it, it becomes real and you are perpetuating it.
Sure.
They don't
sure.
get it that you have to try to, you know, get this to, you know, to educate people and make them more worldly and let them, you know, really appreciate everyone. But people are afraid to do that. They think it's just going to go away on their own.
I was just going to say people also don't think it's real, and that it's like going to the emergency room. Like, am I sick enough to go to the emergency room? I don't think I really am. Maybe I should wait a little bit longer. Like, you can't tell right now in the middle of this, like, am I being oversensitive, or is it really, like, starting to take over? I think that's part of it.
Yeah, but I have to say one positive thing about social media. On social media right now, if you really look, there is, like, Minds No More Anti-Semitism, Jews for South Florida, Stop Anti-Semitism, Women Against Anti-Semitism. I could go on and on and on. And there are so many on there, and we all help each other find the stories. There are so many stories on there. It's unbelievable. I mean, some people have 4,000 people looking, 5,000. So it is there. So that's one positive thing about social media right now. They're tweeting about it. But it's, look, when I first wanted to put my book out, I can remember a publisher saying to me, the Holocaust is not trending. Now, how...
Oh, my God.
Is one lost for words? Yes, one is lost for words. So,
right.
But then when the book became quite so well, you know, it got on the Wall Street Journal, 12 countries picked it up. It's funny, Germany and Israel did not pick the book up. So, I mean, they're tired of the Holocaust, or they think they know it all. But now everybody, then people started to get interested in it. But it's, we live in such a strange times where everything's sound bites. No one actually tells a real story. And there's a stories are edited in the way the news chooses to do it. You know, I mean, I haven't heard on one news about one of these things that have been happening in Brooklyn. I don't know if you have. I haven't heard it on the nightly news, not one of them. I haven't heard it on CNBC. I haven't heard it on MSNBC. Haven't heard it on CNN. Haven't even heard it on Fox.
No, I heard it. I heard it on 1010 Winds. And I think the New York Post may have had something. I don't know.
But it's not
big enough in their brain, you know, to kind of underscore it. Yeah.
But Lois, I truly think if this was happening to the gay community, to the black community, to the transgender community, we would hear something. If all of a sudden 4 people in 1 week in the gay community were being beaten or hit by, we would hear something.
Maybe.
I think absolutely.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is many people think Jews can take care of themselves.
That's very true. You just answered your own, you know, point there. That's what it is. They think that Jews are smarter, people are jealous of us, we're better looking, we're more fashionable, whatever. Right. But they don't understand the effort that gets put into that. But I want to ask you, Trish, before, because we really want to get into this, why did you write The Pharmacist of Auschwitz? You know, what was it? Was it a reminder?
Well,
I mean, what? I mean, you could have written about a million things. Why? And you devoted so many years to this. What happened?
Well, I think, you know, my own personal story, if I can just give you a little bit of it. It's
please.
A passion.
Definitely.
I was brought up in a modern Orthodox Jewish family, obviously, modern Jewish, oxymoron there. What city?
Tell everyone.
In England, in London. And at that time, you know, believe it or not, there was such stuff as segregation for Jews and blacks. So, you know, it did exist. And it was a time when my mother wanted me to go to an all-Jewish school with all girls. And I was so rebellious, and I said, no, I want to go to a mixed school. So she said, okay, you'll go to a mixed school, but you know, it's got to be all girls, so whatever. When I was at school, dirty Jew, all Jews have got big noses, you know, all Jews have got big feet, go back to where you come from, which I found quite extraordinary because I was, you know, from England. And and it was really, really, really bad. I mean, you know, it was a bad time to be Jewish. Even leaving school and going to get a job was not easy because my maiden name then was Levine, and it was discriminating. It was really, really hard. And then it's in 1985, after I came to America in New York, I met Joseph Mengele's son through, because Gerald had been writing a book on Mengele. And that was really, really difficult for me because I couldn't bring my, it was hard for me to meet with him in the beginning, but I eventually did. All I kept on thinking was, what would my mother think? You know, the mums are always right in the mind. And he mentioned in the while we were interviewing him that he talked about this pharmacist of Auschwitz, and I thought to myself, Auschwitz had a pharmacist at that time. Not thinking, you know, of course they needed one for the guards and everything. And then when I walked home with Gerald that evening, remember there was no, you know, go home and Google in someone's name or anything. Everything had to be done the hard way. So it took about, let's say, a long time for the book to come about. So 31 years later, I'm here, you know.
Wow.
But it was interesting because when we walked home, I kept on saying to Gerald about, oh, how can they have a pharmacist? But of course, when you think back in retrospect, of course they have a pharmacist because they've got 7,000 people working there. They've got to be taken care of, you know, for typhus, lice, whatever is going on there.
And also you talk about the corporate infrastructure, how corporations kind of kept fueling this, whether it be the parent company of Bayer or whatnot. We're all part of this.
Yeah, IG Farben, yeah. Well, you know, there was a work camp there, which was Auschwitz III, which was called Monowitz. And it was all about death and business, death and business. They literally worked the people to death, literally.
Unbelievable. So how can we ever turn this around? Or is this a problem, the anti-Semitism globally, or at least in America? Is this something that we're just going to have to try and cope with, or is it able to be turned around, or what will it take to dissipate?
I hate to sound like a doomsday, but I think we can only turn it around is that we have to be out there. We have to speak about it. We have to defend ourselves. You know, we can't allow this to continue without being, I mean, like you're doing this program today, you know, it's informing people, letting people understand what's going on out there, whether it's through your podcast, whether it's through social media, and people like me, and people can't be afraid. They have to come out and do it. But like Lois said earlier, I think a lot of people are very scared to come out and voice what they really feel and what's going on. You know, I can't believe that. I mean, I can't believe that it can change, but it might get worse before we actually get to that point. I think that's what the problem is.
Tricia, didn't you think that your book was going to do some of that? I mean, I would think that if we did more education with your book and people read it and they truly, I mean, I have to tell you, when I was reading your book, I have it on, an e-book and I have it on Audible. I had like a cover over my head. I couldn't stand parts of it. I was just so squeamish, like I was afraid to read the next sentence. I did it like, you know, with my hands over my eyes and my hands over my ears, filtering it. Don't you think a book like yours could do great work for that?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think it's a shame especially for the young ones that they don't put these, I mean, into the school system so they can learn. But I don't think they even learn about World War II or anything. I don't think they, I mean, there are people you talk to who don't know what the Holocaust is or was. So that's another scary part there. You know, we're talking to ourselves almost. You
right.
Know, the people that
that's
need
very
to
true.
Read it don't, the people that need to read it don't, you know.
Right.
And you know, I mean, think about it also. They did a survey recently where, I mean, you were talking earlier about that, where in the U.S. and Europe show a shocking percentage of millennials are about a third, or a third even in Germany, don't know anything, don't know nothing about the Holocaust.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, it's really scary. So that, and I agree with you because my book is definitely fresh. And And all these survivors are dying, so we're losing the stories. I mean, we go around to the schools. We have been invited to schools to talk, and we do go and to try and help educate the kids of all age groups. But it's a terrible situation. I don't know what the answer is right now.
I can tell you, I was absolutely shocked. I mean, it takes a lot to shock me because I'm pretty much a cynic. Uh-huh. But when the Charlottesville thing happened and they were chanting, yeah, Jews won't, you know, don't let Jews won't replace us. Don't let Jews replace us. Or I mean, first of all, I couldn't believe that was even a thing in their head. I didn't understand what they meant. I couldn't believe that, you know, this was what the chant was at Charlottesville. I'm still kind of floored by it. I just cannot believe it.
It's funny you should say that, but I didn't know what they meant either. I mean, right. I've heard some horrific stuff like, you know, Hitler didn't finish the job, go back in the ovens.
Yeah,
the usual. But that, no, I couldn't, I don't think I could really understand what that was all about. I don't think many people could. It was very strange.
Trish, before we go any further, how many countries translated your book and, you know, and are selling your book right now?
12.
Name some of them, just so we have it on record.
Let me think. There's England, France, Spain, China, Netherlands, Romania, Czechoslovakia.
How did that happen?
Well, that was a very interesting way that happened. My publisher in England found this. He works with this Laura Bella. Works with this foreign, she's an agent, Lorella, and she goes out and tries to sell your book to all, like, foreign rights. And that's how that happened. And it was, I have to tell you, it was an absolute, there was no time was that on my mind or on my door that was going to happen. So I was completely blown away and shocked by that.
That's amazing, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the first one happened, and I was like, oh, wow, that's good. And then when the second and the third, you know, it was a real surprise to me, pleasantly, of course.
So what was the reaction of a lot of the writers and the readers around the world, you know, go ahead.
I was very lucky. Historians, writers were surprisingly found it fresh, a fresh read of the Holocaust. And they were, you know, Holocaust people that have been doing this for years. I mean, I got some really, really good compliments for it. I have to say, yes. Not only about the way it was written, but about the content as well. It was new and fresh to them. It's hard to believe there can be something new and fresh in the Holocaust, right? But one for the right. I know.
Has there been any interest from making it into a film? I mean, it seems like it has.
There's always interest. You know, someone comes here and says, you know, this would make a good miniseries. Somebody else says this would make a good documentary. Somebody else would say this would make a good movie. But nothing solid yet. You know, in our industry, one always hears this, but it's until it's actually, you know, solid. Mm. We've been through it many times. But no one, I haven't optioned it to anyone yet, no.
So, Tricia, which countries really were you surprised by that had very good sales?
I think Brazil and Poland.
Wow.
They were at the top 10 list. And then Bertrand's in Lisbon, which is one of the world's oldest bookstores, it was number one. So that was amazing to me.
Wow, that's great.
That is amazing.
Because it's expensive to do that. You know, you have to translate them and everything for them to do that.
So I'm curious, Trish, you mentioned before that you have never been to Israel. I'm curious as to why, and I'm also curious that, you know, what do you think about, you know, Germany today? Would you visit there, go to Europe? You know, after writing this book, you know, what do you feel about those places?
Okay, so the reason I didn't go to Israel is really interesting. It was because I was meant to go with my aunt and uncle, and my uncle got very sick, and we canceled the trip. So that was the beginning and the end of it. And
right.
Why we haven't gone further, I don't know. I think what's happened with us is that we always get tied up with our book projects. and that book project takes us to another place. So we never get to have a holiday. That holiday becomes book research. And so our trips and our book research come on. So, you know, we've discussed many times, oh, we want to go to Israel, want to go there, but it never comes to pass. But that doesn't mean it's not going to.
Yes, but how do you feel about visiting Germany
I was in Germany in 1983. We did the Berlin Document Center there.
Right.
I went once. I have no desire to go back. I'm living in a country I love, so there's no reason for me to want to go anywhere else.
I'm only asking you because I'm very confused and naive. Steve and I and Elliot and a few of our friends, we just did a trip in Germany for like about 10 days. And, you know, I keep reflecting when we got back and even before, you know, we found it so charming. But, of course, all the people we spoke to were not even alive during the Holocaust.
Right.
And they said to us, you know, we were taught to be very apologetic and to make sure it didn't happen again. But I was curious, after you wrote your book, you know, would you go to Germany, you know, as an example? I mean, you know, would you give them a dime?
I don't even think about, the time that I did go there, it was in winter. The weather was horrific.
Oh, yeah, it was very bleak. Very gray and very bleak, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unfair in a way because I would never have lived in Germany, obviously.
Right.
But now with the surge of anti-Semitism,
it's a whole other thing.
Let me just say one thing. You know, I have tried to do the, forgiveness thing. It was when Gerald and I bought VW, the Beetle, in 1998.
Oh, that's interesting.
We wrote a piece in the New York Times magazine about making the decision to buy something German. Because I was brought up in a family, obviously, don't buy anything from Germany. I mean, my family was so extreme, they didn't even want me to go to Spain because of the Spanish Inquisition. Do you understand what I'm saying? So,
right.
They were really out there. Mm-hmm. So I was brought up like that. So that was huge for us to buy that. I will say when I was in Germany and I just said it was bleak, I didn't feel comfortable there. I didn't feel great there. It wasn't my place. Okay.
I saw some pictures in Germany of there again these Nazi rallies are reforming and they have red caps that say make Germany hate again.
Mm.
So which is of course a reflection on our current president in the White House. And I think I don't know if he by being in the White House and kind of his agenda is fueling this at all or if it's just fueling itself, but it does seem obviously, they are taking that red cap and taking it across over to Germany as well. So it does make you have to question what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have a problem. Yeah.
So I want to ask you a few more questions, and we're getting long on this, but I want you to describe to Steve and all the people that are listening what your life is like. You know, sometimes I hear Stephen King talking about never leaving the room where he works, but nobody understands the dedication of you and Gerald on being researchers and writers and what it takes out of your life. And I am curious as to, isn't there a time where you just feel like saying, I'm going to the park and I'm going to jump rope and I'm not going to do another beat of work for 3 days. But that doesn't seem to be the case. Even social things that you're invited to, you don't go to a lot because that takes time away from what you're doing. What makes you, Trish, what makes you and Gerald who you are?
I think that it's the passion. We have an incredible passion for what we do, dedication. We really enjoy what we do. It didn't start off that way, And as you know, Lois, how consuming it becomes for us. We're extremely disciplined, so. We don't go to an office. We work from home. So we really discipline ourselves when we get up. But there are times when there's no doubt. You want to just scream. But then again, you have to remember, we pay the bills this way. The mortgage has to be paid. So there's no way we can slack off in any way. And normally every book that we work on, and we work on the books together, one at a time, we are passionate about the subject, which we're very lucky. You know, many people don't get the opportunity to get to write what they really want and be passionate about what they write.
But there are days that you never even leave the house. Isn't that true?
Yes, yes, that is true. Yes, it is true. Yes, absolutely. It's but the funny part is we never really get stir crazy, but then we do try to get out, you know. It never goes past one or two days that I have.
Trish, how many books do you start and not finish? Or if you start a book, it's always the end?
No, it's never happened.
Oh, really? Yeah. If you guys start a book, you finish a book. You don't have a
full start. Yeah, well, because you remember, we're writing for a publisher. So say Joe's doing his book for Simon & Schuster, or I'm doing my book for Krutz. You're expected to deliver your product, right? You know, so they've paid you. I mean, you know, some people get paid in advance up in front. I, by the way, was not paid a penny for my book in the beginning.
Wow.
Not a penny, no. Well, it was done on the understanding, because I decided, I didn't get an American publisher. I have a British publisher, Krutz, who's brilliant. And Chris LaSalle, sorry. And he said, look, what we'll do is we'll see how the book does and we'll split whatever it is. And so I just got very lucky. I sold well. We sold, as you heard, you know, 12 countries. So I did very, very well. I did unexpectedly very well. Financially, it was rewarding as well. And it wasn't meant to be. Whereas Gerald's is different, you know, in that situation.
Do you and Gerald ever get into arguments?
I mean, they're always about, and I'm sure you know, you've been married for many years, they're always the silliest things.
Yeah.
They're never about anything serious. I mean, he's a debater. I'm a debater. You know, he might have pulled the chair out the wrong way and it aggravated
me. Right. That's what happens. You don't scream at each other.
No, not really. I can be a bit of a screamer, but that's for sure.
Are your arguments ever based over an issue in a book? Like, I think it should go in this direction. I think it should go in this direction.
No. We are so lucky. We're both
They're crazy, Steve. They're crazy.
We understand constructive criticism, okay? And that, if you're in the arts, and you know this, your industry as well, film, TV, music, if you can't take constructive criticism, you might as well close up and go to bed, because it's just, that's the way it is.
Right.
Now, you might say to each other, well, I don't agree with you. I think it sounds good that way. But remember, there's always an editor that's going to change it anyway.
Right.
You know, but no, there's never a problem there. No.
So, Trish, we don't have much time, but I wanted to know, why was Victor Capesis, I don't even know if I'm saying his name correctly.
Capesis.
Why did he get such a small sentence of 9 years and then he was released after 10 months? I'm still startled.
Because he was a small fish in a big pond. He wasn't Joseph Mengele, who they were hunting for. You know, a lot of these people, like the industrialists, got...
But they all should have stayed in jail forever. I don't understand this kind of behavior.
Well, they just, you know, they did these deals, and I was going to say, to use an American expression, they were cut loose. And, you know, he was only one of dozens in, you know, the Auschwitz trials.
Right.
And, you know, he was acquitted of, you know, in a way that it's so hard for us to understand the judicial, you know, system. It's very, very difficult to understand.
I mean,
it makes me angry to think when he went home and he arrived and he was going out. He was, you know, he was welcomed by applause and cheers.
I know. That chilled me to death.
No one thought he did anything wrong. But that's, you know, that's what's so amazing about that. And I think the other thing we didn't touch on, but, you know, obviously gets me crazy, crazier than crazy, is the Holocaust deniers. It's like, what else can we put up with? I mean, that means that all those Holocaust survivors are lying. You know?
Yeah, well, I know. These are very sick people.
Yeah.
Sick. I mean, these are people you cannot budge off of a lot of topics. They're they're distorted, and they're dumb.
But
you know what? They reproduce. They tell their kids the same thing.
Absolutely.
And it goes on and on.
Gerald did an interview many years ago with a vermin anti-Semite, David Irvin, a Holocaust denial. And we were in London at the time, and it was a really surreal meeting because it was, if anyone knows London, it was in Oxford Street, just off of there, and Gerald went into the apartment. I had to stay outside in the rain, and he wouldn't let me in, and his wife was sick with cancer in the back room. And, you know, this guy is a very smart historian, so he can twist it so well. And what you just said, Steve, is so true. They just keep telling the story to the next generation, and, you know, it's very frightening.
It's very frightening.
So our last question, Trish, is we're curious. Do you feel safe when you write the books and you promote the books? Did anybody ever come over and throw a shoe at you?
Let me tell you this. I have been writing books with Gerald for many years. And if, when we went to Thailand and Hong Kong, and we were looking, you know, I remember I was, that we had to go to Chiang Mai, and we spent months, by the way, in Southeast Asia. And that was in the Golden Triangle, before it was kind of a chic to go there now. And with all the heroin dealers and the gangsters and me being moved from a hotel because that hotel was being run by drug dealers, and that was in 1987. And so I think that prepared me for anything that was going to be ahead of my time. And the, you know, these, we don't think about it. It's really strange. The only time it really came to the forefront for us was get people a bit crazy. I mean, I never thought a book would get people so crazy was Case Closed, when Gerald did, you know, Oswald Did It Alone. That got people really, I'm talking about.
God, I love it.
We were attacked on the plane. We had a rat sent to us with, you know, a rat's tail, a dead fish. I mean, it was really something. I mean, I was in complete shock by it. So, no, I mean, I think you get fearless. I don't know if I look back now whether I would do some of the things I did in the early days, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my favorite part, by the way. My favorite part of this whole process is the research, the interviews, the files, the documents.
You don't love the fame and the glory when you're at a bookstore and everybody's like, sign this, we'd love you. Can I take a picture with you?
I hate this. If you knew how nervous I was just to prepare for this, you have no idea. I actually...
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. You don't come off like that at all.
At all.
Yeah.
You know, it's really funny because I'm good. Like, if I see you, Lois, and we chat and I'm one-on-one and I can get into it. But once I know I have to do a TV or a radio or a podcast or go into, I mean, I start getting a dry mouth. I think I'm going to get a migraine. I mean, I am absolutely terrified of doing it. So if I can do it, anybody can do it. Gerald's the best at this, you know.
Yeah,
you
really.
You say to Gerald, there's 1,000 people tomorrow. Can you go and speak? Oh, yeah, I'll go.
When I look at Gerald, I always think that he's got sort of like, you know, some kind of glasses on or a folder on each side of his, head, because he's so focused that even if something was going on, you know, he would be so focused that he would not even hear what someone said, or he would ignore it. And you're like that too. But I do want to end with this. You are a very rare, the two of you, rare birds, because no, I mean, Steve doesn't understand, because I've been watching you from afar for years, how dedicated and how the two of you work like as if you're Siamese twins. I even saw you at a meeting. Your heads get crocked the same way. You turn the same way. You'll take the same drink from the table. You'll greet people the same. It's scary. It's a very scary process. And it's to be admired, and it's one of a kind of, and people should cherish you, because when we're all out having a slice of pizza and bullshitting about nothing and wasting time in our lives, you and Gerald are doing God's work. You really are.
Sweet.
And I am so proud to know of you, to know
I'm
you.
I'm proud to know you. I really am.
Yeah.
I mean,
Steve, so anything you... All right, let Steve wrap this up.
Well, first of all, I'm proud to know both of you.
I'm proud to know you.
and, 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 I'm thrilled, Trish, we were able to terrify you today. That was fun. And I think on that note, I just want to say I'm Steve Greenberg, and I'm with
Lois Whitman.
And we have been Lying on the Beach. So long, everybody.